Welcome to Story of a Storyteller. I'm your host, Connor Braden. This is the show where I found out all about the ins and outs of the lives of storytellers of all kinds. You can find my free novella, The Stolen Dagger, episode show notes, links to all sorts of amazing books, and more at connorbraden.com/podcast. Enjoy!
Just write down what you want to see. I think that's my biggest advice.
But I'm more focused on uniting people.
She said to me, I never would have dreamed. You are a writer.
If the normal works for you, great. If it doesn't, don't beat yourself up over it.
I think anybody can get the words on the page, but a real writer will know how to fix it.
I always kind of feel poverty and hunger nipping at my heels.
Realizing that I wasn't mad.
The one mistake people make when they're submitting things is submitting them too early.
And then my brain just went, you're going to write a book.
You put your heart and soul into a book.
Hi diddly ho. This is episode 8 of Story of a Storyteller podcast. I've really been looking forward to talking about this episode for a long time. Today's interview is another Irish author, Sarah Webb. Sarah has been writing for over 20 years, and most of the books she has written is for children. She is a champion and an advocate for children's books and stories, and her love of a good story and her passion for children's literature is just infectious. She will have you excited about every kid's book ever after listening to this interview. Sarah talks about how she got into writing and how she was originally working in different bookshops all around Dublin, and how she just basically saw people kept requesting a book and she said, hey, that book doesn't exist, so I'm going to write it, and that kind of started her off. She just released a new non-fiction book, Animal Crackers, a fun fact book about all sorts of animals that she wrote alongside another Irish author and illustrator, Alan Nolan. And then she has another book she speaks about in this podcast, actually, The One with the Waggedy Tail, illustrated by Steve McCarty, and that's actually out on October 18th, 6 days after this episode is going to release. So congratulations, Sarah. Sarah's website is in the links section of the show notes of the podcast, so you can check out all of her books, all of her many, many, many books, and buy any ones you like. Now for the writing report. I realise I never actually gave my word count goal for the last week, but it's kind of become irrelevant now, because I suppose my writing now is Halloween or bust, to put a name on it, and it seems to be really working. I mean, today as I record this right now, it's October 3rd, and I have 86,000 words written, more or less, and I have 28 days till Halloween. So even though I'm currently writing 500 words a week, 500 words a day during the week, and then the weekend I get around 1,000 words a day, which is great, because technically I only have to do 300 words a day to be finished by Halloween. So I'm ahead of schedule, but that scares me, because that just means I know I'm going to fall behind in another stage. But sure, what can I do? Enough about me. Anyway, let's hear from Sarah. Before the interview, though, I just want to give a small heads up that on the day I recorded this back in August, the internet connection wasn't the best, and so when we recorded, Sarah does sound a little bit choppy here and there. I worked really hard on it though, and I got it as listenable, even though that's not really a word, as possible, and I am fairly happy with it, that you'll be happy with it too, but I thought it would be unfair of me not to give you a heads up. So and as well as that, Sarah is just such a good speaker, and she talks so excellently, and she's so interesting and so fun, and she's so brilliant, that I thought it wouldn't be fair to not release it just because the audio isn't 100%. So there's your heads up. Enjoy Sarah, enjoy her advice, enjoy her stories, and I'll talk to you after. Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of the Story of Storyteller podcast, and I am extremely excited about my guest today. My guest today is children's author Sarah Webb. How are you, Sarah?
Hello, I'm very good. Thank you, Connor. Excellent. Good.
Thank you so much for stripping yourself away from the beach and dragging yourself inside to do this. I know that wasn't very easy to do, I'm sure.
It's fine, don't worry. I like talking about books and writing and stories. So, and I'm always happy to support teachers as well. Very important.
Yes.
People.
And on that, actually, I want to formally thank you for the wonderful initiative you did during May and June, the messages for sixth class. So for anyone who's listening that isn't like connected to the primary school world, of course, schools closed in March. And Sarah wonderfully started off an initiative where she got other authors and sports people and politicians, like there was everybody in any walk of life, to give a message to the sixth class kids who are leaving primary and going into secondary. I thank you as a teacher. I thank you for that.
You're most welcome. It was a really interesting project. And yeah, everyone I asked said yes. So it was amazing. Sinead Burke, who's a brilliant activist. And we had all kinds of really interesting people. So yeah, it was good fun.
So to get stuck into more about you, I'd like to start with your beginning. So could you tell me a little bit about what it was like growing up in Dalkey in South Dublin?
Sure, yeah. So my mum also grew up in Dalkey. My dad was from the north side. And I went to national school in Dalkey, St. Patrick's National School. My mum was a primary school teacher. So that is really where the kind of love of books came from, because she read to me constantly. And she was very aware of the importance of reading to children before they got to school, so that they associated books with home and with love and with parents or guardians or grandparents, rather than directly with school, which I think is really important. I couldn't really read myself until I was nearly 10, I was 9 and a half before I started getting it. But she never gave up to me on me, and she kept reading to me over and over again. So when I did get it, I was full of stories, even though I hadn't read them myself.
I think that's the important thing, is to inspire that love of story, because that's why people read. They don't read because they like the act, they read because they like the stories.
Yeah, absolutely. They read because they like getting into the stories. So that was amazing. And then I read a lot. Once I got it, I really, really got it. I read a huge amount. Blighton, Noel Stratfield, Famous Five, Dick Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, all that kind of thing. Became a huge, huge reader. And I think most people who write or who want to write start off as huge readers. I think that's the kind of common thread. I haven't met any good writers who weren't huge readers, or who aren't huge readers. I think it's really important, you know?
Yeah, it's kind of like it's very hard to write if you don't know how to read a good story and know what a good story is.
Yeah, I mean, I always tell the kids it's like music. Like, you wouldn't try and be a musician if you'd never listened to music, or you wouldn't try and be a professional sports star if you'd never actually played the sport you want to play. You know, it kind of makes sense. They kind of get it then. They go, all right. Yeah. So it's like an apprenticeship. It's really important.
That's a really nice way to put it, actually. It's an apprenticeship.
And it's a fun one, too.
That's going to be my excuse next time that I'm reading instead of writing. I'm going to be, no, it's my apprenticeship. I'm working on my skills. Yeah. And like you've mentioned just there, that when you mentioned to kids, you're actually not more than a writer. You're very passionate about children's books and teaching creative writing to children. Does this stem from your own experience with reading and writing as a kid, or is this something that kind of developed when you're an adult?
That's kind of an interesting one, because I don't remember being read to in school until about fifth class. I don't think it was the general thing then, and I'm really glad that it is now. You know, the teachers know that it's an important part of the class. And often it's the teacher's favourite part of the day too, when they get to share stories that they love. So it was only in fifth class. I had a wonderful teacher who was actually an ex-nun called Miss Cahill, and she did a lot of Shakespeare with, and she did a lot of poetry with us. We did Seasons of Mist and Mellow Fruitfulness and Upon the Ridge and Daffodils, and she had us kind of learning off all these in fifth class, so we were only, 11? So that had a huge influence on me, I think, and I can, even now, I remember a lot of the things that she got us to learn. In senior school, what I remember most is the fact that there were no women in my poetry book apart from Emily Dickinson. And wow. I remember asking, it was called soundings. And I remember asking my English teacher, who was a very nice Northern Irish man called Mr. Agnew. And I said, why are there not more women in the poetry book? And he said, oh, Sarah, because women weren't writing at the time. And I said, but Mr. Agnew, like, there's living men in the poetry book. And I know there's living women poets. Like, why aren't they in? And he just didn't know what to say. So And now it's funny. My daughter just got her school books delivered, online from an Irish company. And I was looking through, and it's not half and half. There are, I think, 3 women and 6 men or something. But at least it's better. It's getting there. But that kind of influenced me as well, because I thought, well, you know, there are loads of other stories out there that I want to tell that haven't been told before, because... and that's where a book like Blazing a Trail came in, which is about Irish women who changed the world, people like Mary Robinson and Mariah Edgeworth, who was an amazing writer, who's kind of forgotten a little bit now. So, but all of these things, I think, just school did definitely influence me as a writer, but not perhaps in the way you might think it would. Like, we didn't know creative writing in school at that time. And I did... English and Trinity, but I didn't do creative writing. I did, you know, modern English. So I think it was more to do with the amount I was reading and thinking that influenced my writing rather than school as such. That makes sense.
It's so, you can nearly say it was the lack of other voices. It's almost like you're an activist in a way, of having a variety of stories and stuff put in front of children.
Yeah, well, it's really, really important. Another book I wrote, which is called Sunny Days and Mooncakes, is about a young girl. She's Vietnamese, living in Ireland. She's adopted, and she has selective mutism. And I knew some children with selective mutism and other children with severe anxiety. The conditions are kind of linked. And I didn't see them on the page. So again, you know, it was a story I wanted to put down on the page. I mean, I think the first thing, if you want to write for children, is you have to find stories that you really want to tell, that you're really passionate about, and that you really care about. And if those children that you're writing about, or the adults you're writing about, are different or tell a different kind of story, or tell a story that hasn't been told before, then that's an added bonus. But I think it has to kind of start just from being really passionate about what you're writing about, you know.
Yeah,
I can't remember your question now, Connor.
Honestly, I can't either, but I could listen to you talk about it all day. So perfectly fine. I was looking through your website and I saw that you mentioned the earlier things you had published was in a school magazine. Do you remember what was the first thing that you had published, and was it something you'd stand by now, out of curiosity?
First thing I had published was a piece of non-fiction about why people should read books rather than watching television, which I think is kind of funny. I wrote that in sixth class, and it was always in you. Seniors. Yeah, but I love good television, you know. I love kind of good shows, and I love movies, like I love good films, as well as reading. I think story, however it comes, in what form, whatever form it comes, is amazing. But that was the first piece I've published, you know, published for others to read. And then I wrote a story about a tramp called The Little Tramp. They were the first two things in the school magazine, but I regularly wrote for the school magazine. So obviously I regularly submitted things, which is interesting looking back, because it obviously meant that I wanted other people to read my work, even at quite that was like, and I wasn't long reading at that stage. I must have only 12, I think it was 12 when I first started submitting, and then I did that through senior school. So yeah, there was always that urge for people to read my work, which I think is interesting. And I run writing clubs for kids, and there are some kids who have that huge, a real urge to share their work. I don't know where it comes from. It's probably a big failing in me anyway. I don't know, but it is there, which is interesting. Yeah,
it's and that's something I'm learning across the board in these interviews to this podcast, is there's so many writers that it was always in them in some way. And for a lot of people, sometimes it's only as I'm asking them the questions, they're like, actually, yeah, it was always there. It just, so it's interesting how it's, you know, it seems to be in most of anyone who does write, it seems to have always been part of them.
Yeah, it is interesting. And I think, you know, you have to have that drive in order to get published, because it's not easy and it can be a long road sometimes. Sometimes there's luck involved and you can just hit the right story at the right time. But, you know, it's not an easy road. So I think to have that drive and to have just that kind of determination from quite a young age actually stands to you, you know.
It seems that throughout your life you were surrounded by books and by stories, because I know you're first published in a school magazine, and then you're working in bookshops, then writing children's book reviews and more. So at what point did you decide to actually start writing for children, and what was the thing that started that?
Well, I was working as the children's buyer in Waterstones in Dawson Street, and I noticed that we often had tourists, especially American tourists, coming in looking for cookery books for children. And there wasn't anything. There still really isn't. So I just saw a gap in the market. I thought, wow, okay, a cookery book for kids with recipes that kids can do. There's lots of them now. I mean, if you go into a bookshop now, there'll be lots and lots of different ones. But this was in the 90s and there really was very little. So I decided I'm the right one. and that's what I did. And I was a single mum at the time. I brought up my son Sam for 8 years on my own. And I also was really looking to buy a car because I used to bring him to his childminder, and it rains a lot in Ireland, and we'd get soaked because the childminder was a good walk away from where I lived. So I'd work, and then, you know, I'd collect him from childminder, and then I'd have to push him home in the buggy, but the both of us would get soaked. So I said, right, I'm getting a car. But booksellers, unfortunately, aren't that well paid. So I decided that I would, and that's when I started writing for payment. I actually wrote for a newspaper called Southside News for a few years, and that kind of gave me the confidence then to write a book. So that kind of came first. Then I got the idea for the book, and then I gave the book a go. But it turned down by lots and lots of different publishers. I found a rejection letter from Gill Books, who were Gill and Macmillan at the time, for that book, which is funny. And sent it to Children's Press, who were a very small independent Irish children's publisher that just did children's books. And they rang me up and she said, it's not correct. It needs a lot of work. And some of it's pretty bad. She's very direct. But if you're willing to work on it, we'll give it a go. So I was like, oh, okay. I think she knew I worked in Waterstones, and I'd actually met her. Her name was Rena Dardis. She passed away a few years ago. Amazing woman. But she was willing to take it on and to work on it with me, which we did. And that book is called Kids Can Book. And I think it came out about 1996, 97, something like that.
97.
Was it? Well, yeah. I can't remember. I've done quite a few books since then, Connor, so it's like...
Yes, you have. I actually tried to count, and the max number I got to was 40. Does that sound
okay? Yeah, it might be. I do need to count them at some stage. Yeah. That could be right.
it's some legacy. It's amazing, really, to have.
Yeah, well, I'm not quite Enid Blyton yet, but yeah, it's
no, good. No, yeah. Catch up.
I know she did 300 or something. No, I'm happy. You know, that's a good effort.
It is. It really, really is. What do you think, so when you're writing your first book, which was a non-fiction book as well, it's unusual for a children's author to have non-fiction as their first book. So what was it that was the hardest part of writing that first book?
Finishing it. To be honest, it was a lot of work. It was hilarious that I was writing a cookery book. But I just had an idea and I thought it would do well, because as a bookseller, and I later went on to be children's marketing manager and buyer in Easton, so I have quite a good marketing head on me. So I just saw a gap in the market. And that has happened with a few books I've done, you know, Blazing a Trail, which I mentioned a few minutes ago. Like, that book has done incredibly well and has won awards both here and in the UK. But it just came from me just saying, well, where are the books about Irish women, you know? And there wasn't any. So there were some for adults, but nothing for children. So yeah, so the hardest bit was finishing it, to be honest. And but after I did that one, I did two more nonfiction with Children's Press. And then I went to the dark side for a while and wrote commercial fiction for 10 years, which people often don't know that I wrote a whole load of commercial fiction for many, many years. And then I went back to, I was doing both for a while, and then I realised actually my heart was in children's books, even though everyone thought I was insane for leaving the world commercial fiction. But I haven't looked back. I've just loved it so much that I can't really see myself going back to writing books for grown-ups anymore. But never say never, you never know.
Yeah, never say no, I think, is a really important mantra to bear in mind. Yeah, when you're working in a creative field, you know. you're the first full-time writer that I'm interviewing for.
I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
I mean, it's a compliment. You can take it.
Oh, good. Okay.
but there's one question I really want to ask you that I think a lot of any part-time writers would really be interested in hearing your answer on it. Like, what was it that made you take that step to leave your day job, whatever it was at the time, and decide, right, this is me now for good. I am a writer full time. Like, I'm sure it was scary. I'm sure there was a risk involved.
Yeah. Well, there's always a risk involved, of course, because you're going from, like, I had a very good job in Essence, and, you know, I would have had pension and, you know, and I just left that behind. But I suppose I had at that stage, it was about 17 years ago now, because actually it was 18 years because my daughter's 17 and I left when I was pregnant with my daughter. That's what I do remember. I think just I really loved working in Essence and I loved working as a bookseller. But just the drive was killing me. I was driving over to Santry every day to change traffic. And it'd been so good. Like, I went from full-time to part-time just so I'd have a bit more time to write. But it just came to a stage where I really wanted to commit myself to writing as much as I could. You know, life's short. And even then, because I was in my early 30s then, I just knew that there were loads of books I wanted to write. And if I was working so much as well, I'd never get them done. And loads of other things I wanted to do, like I work on book festivals and I teach creative writing to kids. So I love them so much. So it was quite a brave thing to do looking back. But at the time, I didn't worry about it too much. I just did it, which is interesting. But I think that's because I was kind of younger. And I was very lucky, that I had a partner who was working full time. So that, you know, that was really, really important as well. But I think even if it didn't, I think I would have done it anyway. So yeah, as I say, 18 years on, and touch wood, another 18 or more. So, but I think just you have to take a leap of faith. But I always say to people, like, if you really love your full-time job, don't leave it. You know, you can write, because I do for 5 jobs now. You can write and work as well in another job. What I think people tend to find difficult sometimes is a job that involves writing. So journalism, writing kind of technical manuals or writing working on websites, that's difficult because you're writing all day. And then, you know, if you want to write a novel, you're writing at night on the weekends. I think that can be very, very hard for people. But I think teachers, like Deirdre Sullivan is one of our greatest writers, you know, and she loves her job. She works with children who are autistic children, and she's incredible. And she also writes at least one or two books a year sometimes. She's amazing. So I think teaching is actually a really good job. Although you're so tired, I know, by the summer, that often it takes a few weeks to decompress so that you can start. But as I say, I do lots of jobs. jobs, and I think it actually feeds into my writing. I don't think if I was just writing, I would get any more books done, you know, which is interesting.
You're actually starting to answer my next question, so I'll just may as well ask it, because this is ideal.
Sure.
So normally when I'm interviewing someone that's a part-time writer, I'd say, what's your typical day like? But you're a full-time writer, so I'm going to ask, what's your weekly structure as opposed to your daily? Because I'm sure it changes.
My weeks can be a bit weird. It depends if there's a festival on or not. If there's a festival on, I'm doing that flat out, you know. But if it's not, kind of like the moment, I write full days on Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday. And then I might do kind of admin, or I might review for the Art Independent as well. So I would do book reviews. I do all kinds of bits and pieces. So I do that maybe on a Thursday and Friday. But during term time, like yourself, I teach at the during COVID, I was teaching 11 online classes a week.
Wow.
So that was like 11 contact hours, and then, you know, yourself, all the other work that goes around all that. Mm-hmm. I think I'll be coming back down to maybe about 6 or 7 hours, just because there's so many children around Ireland who want to do a writing club, you know. I used to do 4 or 5 live ones a week, in a venue in Dunleary, but now there's lots of other children healthcare workers as well who want to join in from around the country. I've even got kids from England. So I'll have to look at that. I'm looking at my timetable at the moment. So yeah, but I do, like, Monday and Tuesday, I'm pretty strict about the writing. Like, I get up, I will do yoga because otherwise my neck would seize up. I go for a walk with the dog. And then I have to do the usual, like making sure the kids are out of the door. I don't have to bring them to school anymore because they do that themselves. They're teenagers. And then I'll sit down at my desk. So I get to my desk maybe around 10, half 10, 11, depending on the day. And then I just stay there until I've done what I think is a good word count for the day. Or, you know, until I feel that I've done a good piece of work.
Yeah.
And then that would be maybe 1 or 2, I get up again. But I stay there from 11 till about 2. And that for me is a really good writing day. And I'm like, yeah, kind of 1,000 words done, 1,500, something like that, which I think is pretty good. And then I might do a bit of research in the afternoon, or I'll read back what I've done. Or, yeah. So I'm really privileged. Like, I'm really lucky to have those 2 or 3 writing days. But then I love doing the other stuff as well. And then every Friday during term time, I'm usually in school, doing a writers in school visit, which I love. But again, I'm not sure how that's going to look in the autumn. So
yeah,
it's probably going to be a Zoom visit. But that's okay. Yeah. So no, I'd be involved in lots of different things. But I think the thing is, like, as I was saying, like, I do lots of different things, but you have to carve out that writing time. And I teach adults, and I teach writing for children to adults. And I always say to them, I used to do a whole class on motivation and finding time for your work and all these quotes and everything, but I've given up because I realized that if someone wants to do it, they're going to do it. And if someone doesn't want to do it, they're not going to do it. And there's nothing I can say that's going to motivate them. And they have to motivate themselves. And if they're not motivated, there's not much point me, you know, spending 2 hours telling them how to be motivated. It's better just to teach them kind of share ideas and coax them along the way and help them discover their voice and things. It's a far more use of my time. And then for the one, maybe your 2 in class who are really motivated, you know, they're going to do it. They're going to just keep going. And the others are maybe not, but that's okay too. They've had fun on the course, so it's good.
Yeah, it works out.
Yeah.
So, as I said, you've written 40 books, and I figured out. So I actually looked back. Kids Cook was February 1998, actually.
Wondrous. Wow. Cool.
And I worked it out. That's 1 book every 6 months. That's
okay.
That's the rate you seem to work at, which to me is unreal. It took me 3 years to get 1 book done. So
How do you manage to stay that productive? Like, I know you kind of talked there about you sit down at 10:30, 11:00 until 2:00 and you don't get up and you just keep going and going and going. But how do you power through the days when the words just aren't coming?
Yeah, it's funny. I'm not being obtuse or anything, but I've never had a day where I've sat down at the writing desk to write that I haven't written.
Oh, okay.
Now, whether that is sheer stubbornness or I don't know, but I've had many days that I don't get to the desk, you know, because I'm too tired or something's happening, my headspace isn't there, or, you know, I'm not well, needs me, you know, there's a family emergency. There's many days like that. And I never beat myself up. If I can't write, I can't write, and that's okay, you know. But I've never sat down with my hour or 2 hours or 3 hours or whatever to write and not produce something, because even if it's like, even if I just type up a diary entry or, you know, I get myself into it. When I wake up in the morning, if it's a writing day, I'll write in a notebook about what I'm going to work on that day, and I'll work funny little things out. It's not going to be anything that appears in the book, but I kind of write myself into that space. And then when I'm walking the dog, I'll be thinking about what the characters have done and, you know, what I need to do in that scene. And I write my book scene by scene. And sometimes I'll stop bang in the middle of a scene or even bang in the middle of a sentence, because then the next day when I come back to it, it's just there and I just pick it up. I think the worst thing you can do is to put your work aside and not come back to it for a few weeks, because then you have to pick up, you have to read everything again, pick up the train again. So I always say to anyone who's writing for children, is just keep it in your head. If you can't get to your desk every day, let's not, you know, we have lives, we're teaching or we're parenting or we're working. You train the story in that day and think, oh wow, character, or if my character's in this, what would you be like? Or, you know, you can just keep them in your head, and by doing that, you're just keeping the scene so close to your brain, I suppose, and your emotions. When you sit down, it should actually be really hard to just get something down. And, you know, if I only get 300 words down or something, that's okay too. The nonfiction I found was amazing. Because nonfiction, you can work on whatever kind of humor and thing you're in, because you're doing loads of research and then you're getting the facts down. So I'm always telling people starting out writing, like, why don't you try nonfiction? No one's ever listened except for a girl called Aga Grandovitz, who was listening and had a beautiful book published last year or the year before about Irish animals, called Dr. Finch's Compendium of Irish Animals, I think it's called. But she came up with the concept. She found a writer who was really good at nature writing, and she did all the beautiful illustrations. But like, she came up with the concept first. She was in one of my writing classes in the Irish Writers' Centre. And she listened. But no one else ever does. But I just think it's such, nonfiction is a brilliant, like, creative nonfiction is such a brilliant way into writing. And teachers are particularly good at it. You know, and there's so many interesting stories out there from Ireland about amazing people, amazing places, amazing animals, that I think we're only just starting. And I think children love nonfiction. You know, they love really good nonfiction books. And children nowadays are very visual. You know, they read pictures all the time. You know, they're very, very sophisticated visually. So I love really beautifully illustrated books. Again, I can't remember your question.
That's okay. You're answering it wonderfully. Don't worry. And you're kind of bringing me up to the next question. It's a question and a statement, I suppose. Your last nonfiction book that you published, the name's gone from my head. Trailblazers. Sorry,
Dare to Dream was the last one. So there was Blazing a Trail, and then Dare to Dream was the second one. Yeah, that came out last year.
Yes, sorry,
that's all right.
Well, so I wasn't completely wrong.
No, not at all.
One thing I like about that, the fact that those books deal with nonfiction and teaching children, you know, about true life stories, are just can be as fantastical and as amazing and astounding as fiction. Mm-hmm. And in a way, more so, because like the very fact that it really happened, it just lends this extra punch mm-hmm. to it and this extra power to it. Did you write that with the intent of empowering younger children, and especially girls, or was it like with Kids Cook, you saw this gap and you're thinking to yourself, well, I see this gap, surely there's children looking for it?
It started off because, as I was saying, I go to schools every Friday, and the anniversary of 1918 was coming up. Now, 1918, to anyone who knows about kind of women's voting and women's rights, was the year that Ireland gave women the vote. And it was coming up, and I remember talking to a particular class of girls and asking, did they know who our first Irish female president was? And they looked at me blankly. And then I asked them, you know, do you know any Irish suffragettes? And they were like, no. Nope. So I thought, gosh, okay, you know, because I'm really, really, I love Mary Robinson. She's one of my big life heroes. I think what she did in 1990, you know, was extraordinary, and had a huge influence on me as a woman and as a young woman at the time. It was the first time I'd ever voted. So I was just really, really, really wanted to tell people about Mary Robinson. I wanted to tell children about Mary Robinson. And when I go into schools, even now, they don't know who our first president was, unless their teacher is particularly into history and Irish history. And if you go into a school in America, all the children would be able to rattle off who their presidents are. It's part of their curriculum. But over here, it doesn't seem to be taught. You know, they might know a few. They'll know Michael D. they'll know him very well, but they've never heard of Douglas Hyde, and they've certainly never heard of Mary Robinson. So that was my real starting point for the book, was to tell children about Mary Robinson. And then after that, I realized that there's so many other women that I don't know about. They didn't really know about Countess Markovitz, although that was a little better because we'd had the 1916 centenary. Kathleen Lynn, Dr. Kathleen Lynn, who set up the first children's hospital in Ireland. Hannah Shee Skeffington, who was an amazing suffragette. So the impetus behind it, I suppose, was first of all, tell children about that. But yes, I mean, I looked for books that would tell that story, and then I realized, well, there just aren't any, so I'm going to write one. And that has happened a few times over the years, that I've just kind of gone, oh, there's nothing there, well, I'm going to do it. The Irish nursery rhyme book I did, Sally Go Round the Stars, again, I was just looking for a nursery rhyme book that had Irish rhymes in it, and again, there was nothing. So I've now done two of those, and then the third one out in October, the one with the waggly tail, which is another collection of rhymes, including lots of Irish ones, and including some that I've written myself this time. So I don't know what the next gap in the market. Oh, well, the next book I'm writing is also, I just discovered there was nothing really major about the tenements. I'm really interested in the tenements and kind of early 20th century Ireland and how we treated our children at that time, and poverty and the slums, and that's so interesting. So that's the next one I'm writing. I've just finished, in fact, is about the tenements. So I think hopefully it'll be a useful one for schools as well, because I think childhood poverty is something that teachers and schools in particular are interested in, because it's something that their children and their families and their school structure every day. So there you go. The answer is yes, I start with something I'm really interested in, and then it all just kind of waterfalls from there.
That's brilliant. And of course, you mentioned Mary Robinson earlier, and one thing I personally only learned recently about Mary Robinson is how important she was to the gay mm-hmm. rights movement.
Yeah, absolutely.
Herself, David Norris, gets a huge, and rightly so, gets a lot of credit for enabling the European courts to decriminalise. For anyone listening or mm-hmm. watching outside of Ireland, homosexuality was still illegal in Ireland up until 1993. and David Norris is usually the name tied to that, but Mary Robinson was a very equal part of that. So she's also a great empowering symbol for women and girls, but also for gay men as well. And I feel like a lot of LGBT Ireland don't know about that. They know about David Norris.
So she did. She was a lawyer. She was a professor of criminal law in Trinity at the time. She was the youngest ever. She was only 24. So she did a lot of the legal work behind that. Yeah, she was extraordinary. Yeah.
Still is.
And I think Mary McAleese. Yeah, and Mary McAleese as well. You know, they are amazing. Those ex presidents. Yeah.
So to just look a little bit more at writing then for this, is there any, like when you're sitting down and writing, and I'm sure this has changed over the years, your first book from 98 to 2020, I mean, there's a lot of changes in technology and stuff.
Yeah.
Is there any particular software or programs or tools that you use in particular? Is there any that you would be totally lost without?
Well, no, is the honest answer. I don't use anything other than, like, I like writing in pencil and notebooks because I can kind of scribble and I just like it. And also I often write and edit in bed, and I can do it upside down with a pencil. No, not being funny, but no, notebooks, pencils, and just plain basic Word documents is what I use. I do email myself my book every night. I don't know if that counts as something, Jackie Connor. But no, I would have friends who use Scrivener and who use all kinds of things, but no. Just see, I'm writing a children's book, so they're usually between maybe 40,000 and 50,000 words, you know, a middle grade novel. So I can keep all that in my head. So I think if I was writing a much longer book, maybe of 100,000 or 150,000 words, I might need something, especially with my dodgy memory. But no, I can keep it all in my head at that length. So no, just a pencil.
I was really hoping for this, like, groundbreaking, nope, like, software no one knows of that enables you to write a book every 6 months. It's a pen and paper.
Yeah, sorry, Connor.
You know what? It's perfect, because in another interview we talked about how everyone says, and then I picked up the pen and started writing, but it's the keyboard. So I actually wanted to find someone that writes with a longhand. So it's excellent to find.
Well, no, I do a bit. See, I do a bit of both. I do all my editing in longhand. But yeah, definitely all my notes, all my early workings. If I'm particularly tired, I'll let myself write in longhand in bed. But then I do have to type it all out. I do a lot in longhand. Yeah. And it probably slows everything down, but it's kind of how I like to work.
It slows everything down at a rate of a book every 6 months. I'd hate to see you at top speed.
Yeah, I know. I have two out this year as well, so I'm probably two next year. I think two a year, though, is pretty... Yeah, some of them are very short, though, kind of. I think two years is still probably... Book. Yeah, it's probably a good going. Yeah.
Excellent. What do you think, as I mentioned earlier, most of the other writers I'm talking to are part-time, either traditionally published or self-published. What do you think is the biggest myth that part-time writers believe, and it's actually particularly that self-published authors believe, about the traditional publishing world? Is there anything out there that you hear indie or aspiring authors say, and you're just there shaking your head going, no?
Well, I think, I mean, it's not the answer to your question, which I'll come back to in a second, but I think the one mistake people make when they're submitting things is submitting them too early. I think the amount of work that I do before, and I've, as you say, done quite a lot of books, before sending something out, like I would do a huge amount of work. I'd never send something out that had just come to me or that was a first draft. It's often about a sixth or seventh draft goes to my editor, my agent. But I think one thing that there is a slight misconception about is that agents and publishers are always looking for new writers. They're always looking for new talent. And you just have to keep going. I have a friend called Vanessa O'Loughlin, and it took her 15 years to get published, but she never gave up. And she tried lots of different kind of genres, and, you know, she tried kind of romance for a while, but then she kept going back to crime, which is her big love. And now I think they're kind of more psychological thrillers than like pure kind of procedural crime. But it took her so long, but she never gave up. And I think that's extraordinary. But she just hadn't really found her voice yet, and also the story that would get her an agent and get her a publisher. So I think definitely agents and publishers are always looking for terrific new work. And the great news is that unlike, say, gymnastics or swimming or professional football or something, you don't have to be really young and really fit. You know, you don't have to be young at all. I mean, I read a children's book recently that I reviewed, and the writer was in her late 60s. And I read the book before I found this out, and I really liked the book. It was about circuses and boarding schools and things. And I went just to look her up after, because I hadn't come across her before. She was a new writer. And I discovered she was in her late 60s. And I just thought, wow, that's really cool. You know, that's her first book. It's a terrific book. It's full of life. It's really, really fun. And, you know, she only got her agent a couple of years, maybe 2 years before that. So in her mid-60s, she got an agent. And then in her late 60s, she got published. So, yeah, so I think there is a misconception that, you know, it's very closed shop, that they're not looking for new voices, that they've got enough writers, you know, but that's really, really not the case. And every year, brilliant new writers picked up. So I would say if anyone is on that journey, just to keep going, so you're really, really passionate about, you know, I think that is really key.
I agree. I think if you have the grow for it, as we say in Ireland, like you keep going and it'll come eventually. That's amazing that somebody got an agent in their mid-60s, because there's more than likely so many amazing storytellers out there who could be as young as their early 50s and think, ah, no, I'll not bother, times past or whatever. Mm. And no, never. I mean, you often hear in the news of people in their 80s getting their first college degrees and stuff like that. So
yeah,
there you go.
Yeah, why not? And then like when you submit your book, you don't submit it with photographs. So like no one knows. You know, you could be any age. So yeah, it is a meritocracy. I mean, that's a good thing about it. Largely, there are obviously some exceptions, but the agents and in Ireland, of course, publishers are looking for Irish stories. So if you are Irish, you have a kind of advantage if your story is either based in Ireland or has an Irish flavour to it or is about Ireland. And we're very lucky in that we can submit manuscripts directly to the Irish publishers, which is unusual, you know. So I think Irish writers are in a really good position, actually.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's one of the advantages of living in a smaller country. I mean, we can literally ring up a member of parliament and give out about a pothole in the road outside your house, and you can submit directly to a publisher. I mean, it's a great advantage of a small country, I suppose. What do you think? And this is, you're probably going to find this tricky. What do you think has been your proudest moment as a writer so far?
Well, I think that the thing that made me really realize how important books are and how important maybe one of my books is, even though it's kind of not really linked to that, is last year during World Book Day, a young girl's mum sent me a picture, and it was of her little daughter dressed up as Mary Watson. And she was holding Blazing a Trail in front of her, and she said that Mary Robinson had become her daughter's hero. And she insisted on wearing like a really sweet little suit. She had a kind of high neck blouse and strip pearls. And she'd made like a brooch that Mary Robinson had really worn. And she had a wig at the door. And she looked horrible. And I just kind of, it really just made me so happy that a child knew who Mary Robinson was through reading one of my books. So I should probably say winning awards.
No.
I think that was my proudest moment. That, you know, a little school kid, I think she was only in third or fourth class, dressed up as Mary Robinson because she'd read about Mary in one of my books. And I thought that was brilliant. Yeah. So fair juice to her mum as well for the picture. That's really cute.
And I think that's great because there's a writer, I listen to her podcast a lot, and she always says to have your own definition, when you're a writer, to have your own definition of success. And what I love about that little story is the reason you wrote that book was because children didn't know who Mary Robinson was. And then a year or so later, you get a photograph of a child dressed up as Mary Robinson. So there you go. That's
I know. Yeah, it was brilliant. Yeah, I thought it was just so lovely. I still have it. I printed it out. It's beside my desk, stuck to the.
Oh, that's great.
Just because it just reminds me. Really, you know, writing for children is a real privilege, and you can change children's lives. So it's a very, very important job. So, and the stories we tell children, they carry with them through their lives. So, I mean, I remember stories that I read when I was like 10, 11, 12, 13, like no other stories. You're probably the same, Connor. But so it is really, really important that we try and get them brilliant stories while they are, you know, at that really key reading age group. Because as I say, they'll carry them with them through their lives. So I love when they read things like Wonder, that great book by R. Palacio, which is all about kindness. You know, those kind of books that really can make them think about life and about difference and about being decent to other people. And schools obviously play a huge role in introducing books to children, because often not every household has books and not every family is a reading family. So it's a big responsibility, I think, that schools have. And I think Irish schools in particular do a brilliant job of introducing a really wide range of books to children. So well done, Connor. Boulabas.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm going to thank you on behalf of all teachers and not just take all the credit.
Excellent.
So I know we're coming up to time, so I'm going to get to like the last few questions now. First, a very simple question. When we've said our goodbyes and hit stop and everything like that, what's the first thing you're going to do this evening? But the remainder of the evening that there is.
I'm going to go swimming with my family.
Lovely.
Sea swimming. Yep, and the dog. He loves coming too. So yeah, I'll be jumping in the water, Connor.
Great. And I'll be here now editing the go on, like, right, I have to get this perfect. So enjoy the sea.
It doesn't have to be perfect, Connor. It just has to be done. I wouldn't worry about perfect. I don't think perfect really exists.
I love that phrase. That's brilliant. So I'm sure keep writing and publish more books is a goal, but is there any really particular goal that you have as a writer? Is there anything that you're really like, oh, I'd love to do this or achieve that or get this done?
Yeah, I don't know. I think every year is different for me. I mean, I am my agent's and publisher's nightmare in that I kind of bounce around different age groups. I bounce around different styles and genres. So the next two I want to do are introducing periods of history that I'm really interested in to young readers. What I'll do after that, I don't know, Connor. There are a few ideas I'd like to do around creativity in children, because I really think creativity is so, so vital in children's lives, especially nowadays. So I'd like to do something around that. Watch this space. Not 100% sure, Connor, but definitely, yeah, history for the moment, and then maybe something around creativity. They're my next two kind of slots for the next couple of years.
Brilliant. And then, so you told us this earlier that you have a story in the works at the minute that are based around the tenements of Dublin and everything like that. What stage in the writing process are you at now with that? Are you finished your first draft?
Yeah, I've finished the first draft. I'm kind of working on... but I edited it quite a lot as I went along, because I was kind of learning more and thinking more and talking to more people and interviewing people who lived in tenements. So it's more almost like maybe a fifth or sixth draft, because I've just added so many things. So I suppose I'm editing a draft of that. I think this one might be the one that will go to my editor. Hopefully might need one more after this. We'll see. But yeah, it's coming towards the end.
And then last tricky question, are there any goals that you have that you would like to share that has nothing to do with writing at all, because we've just been writing and as you said earlier, you're not just a writer, you teach and you mentor, you run book festivals. So is there anything outside of writing itself?
I don't know. I suppose I've done quite a lot of things that I wanted to do. I wouldn't mind going back. I know it sounds a bit odd, but I wouldn't mind going back to book selling for a while because I loved it. And I love matching books with children. I read so many books. I mean, I think I might read up to about 300 books a year. And half of those are children's books. Now, a lot of them are picture books and nonfiction things, so they're very short. Yeah. But I love matching books with children. And the other thing I'd love to do is I've just started sailing again for competitively after many years of just dabbling a bit. I used to sail a lot. And because of COVID, my partner, who's a very good sailor, he has had to sail with his family because it's odd. So he said, come on, you have to sail with us. And I've really loved it. So I'd like to get better at that. Like I always say, every day is a school day. I'm always learning. And there's an Open University course about aquatic mammals. Dolphins, whales. Well, dolphins are whales. But yeah, so I'd quite like to do that. So lots of things, Connor, is the answer. There's always. Yeah, they're just three things in the short term. Yeah.
That's perfect. And then my last question is very easy. If there's anyone who's listening and would really like to reach out or follow you on Twitter or anything like that, or buy your books, where can they find you?
Well, I am on Twitter. My, is it called a handle? I don't know. It is at Sarah Webb is here. And I am on Instagram. I think I'm at Sarah Webb Writer on Instagram. And my books, you can find them on... I like using independent Irish booksellers where possible. So you can find them on Gusher Books. Raven Books might order them for you. Halfway Up the Stairs, which is a fabulous independent children's bookshop in Greystones, or DeBrayne Eason's Irish companies as well. And the O'Brien Press website will have all my O'Brien Press books. And I have a website, which is sarahwebb.ie. So I'm easy enough to find online, Connor.
Perfect. And then my very last question, what was the last book you read?
Oh, well, I am currently reading Death on the Nile by Robin Stevens, which is the last in her Murder Most Unladylike series, which is super, super, super writer. And before
that... They're colourful covers with the kind of silhouettes, aren't they?
Yeah, they're like Agatha Christie for kids. They're brilliant. And I just finished before that another children's book called Voyage of the Sparrowhawk by Natasha Farrant, which is out, I think, in either September or October, which is a mystery story, a kind of adventure mystery story for children of about kind of 9, 10, 11. Brilliant book. Really, really good. Yeah, so they're the last two.
Brilliant. Sarah, it has been an absolute honor and a joy to get to talk to you. And thank you. I know I said it already in every single email I've sent you, but thank you so much for doing this. It was so good of you. And I'd love to have you back on the podcast someday, if that's all right.
Absolutely, Connor. And best of luck now. I know the teachers are all off back, fingers crossed, hopefully in September. So best of luck with your class and best of luck with your own writing.
After talking to Sarah on the day of the recording and after listening to it again while I was editing it, I just felt so energised and ready to write my children's book and take on the world with it. She's just a great inspiration. And on top of that, the fact that the idea to write a children's book came when I attended an event in the Dublin Book Festival back in November 2019, before the COVIDian times, and she was one of the people on a panel that I attended, and she just was very inspiring, and that kind of planted the seed of writing a kid's book, which I then started the following April during lockdown, which I'm now nearly finished. So even though she had nothing to do with it, there's another book in the world because of Sarah. Now, with episode 8, this is episode 8 finishing up, I'm really gearing up for season 2 now. So after the next 2 episodes, season 1 will end. There'll be an occasional episode between season 1 and 2. And in January, on the first Monday back in January, season 2 will come with 10 new guests. 10 guests that I'm actively searching for. So if you're interested in being a guest, or if there's an author you'd really like to hear, tweet me at storytellpod or at Connor_the_geek, and get in touch and let me know what kind of authors you'd like to hear from. I'd love to hear from authors all over the world, all sorts of backgrounds. I'm always really interested in indie authors, but that doesn't mean I'm not interested in hearing poets or screenwriters or comic book writers or anything. If you're a person that tells stories, I want to know your story. Next week, I will be talking to Chris Hooley. Chris is really one of the first authors I got to know on Twitter, and when he started up a hashtag, the Writing Community Bedtime Stories, which we speak about in the interview. He's the second presenter of the Writing Community Chat Show, or he's the first and Chris Agate is the second. I don't know, they can decide that. He had an amazing story to tell of what it was like for him growing up and his relationship with reading and books. And then he also tells me a heartbreaking story of how he first started writing and his motivation behind that. If you're eager to listen to that, be sure to check out Patreon, where you can listen to it right now. And also, don't forget, if you want to be on season 2 or know someone, there's a link to that in the show notes. So for now, see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you loved listening to this episode just as much as I loved recording it. If you like the show, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts or over on Podchaser. Until then, be good, be brave, and tell stories. See ya.